Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and today I've got a very special guest with me. My guest today is Lauren Anderson. Good evening, Lauren, or good morning for you. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's 2 p.m. in the afternoon here, so it's I'm plenty awake. I'm doing well. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Likewise. Thank you for being with me, Lauren. Look, first of all, Lauren, for those that aren't familiar with yourself and the work that you do, would you mind just giving us a brief backdrop as to what that is?
Not a problem. For those who are not familiar, you mean the 99.9% of the people listening. Where do I start? Well, I run a volleyball club here in the Boise, Idaho in the United States. I did notice that most of your stuff tends to revolve around soccer or football. Having now, I guess, what is this, the second person you've had on who's a volleyball junkie. That's my thing is volleyball. And I've been running this club here for, we're on our 11th year now. So excited about that. It's always fun. And I've been coaching volleyball for 29 years. And I've been playing for 31 years now. So I've coached pretty much every level possible, from 6-year-olds to adults. Collegiate. And the program I run here is primarily 12 to 18 year olds and primarily girls. It's kind of the brief summary, I guess.
Thank you for that. Lauren, you know, you talked there, you know, right at the top of that, you know, that I guess most of my show has been focused around football or soccer, as you may call it in the States. And obviously, naturally, that's my background. You know, your background is much more in the volleyball space, similar to, you know, one of my recent guests, John Kessel. I think it's a great point to make in that, I guess, through the origins of the podcast, it was mainly focused around me and my industry, so to speak. However, I'm sure you'll agree, coaching is such a transferable thing. And some of the concepts that we all use, whether we are in the sport of football, volleyball, basketball, whatever sport that may be in, there's a lot of transferable elements that we can kind of take from one another. And, you know, as John put it best, you know, if we share an apple with one another and we exchange apples, we've still got one apple, but if we can share ideas, then, you know, that the possibilities are infinite in that respect. So I kind of want to, you know, pick your brains and, you know, maybe have some discussions where we can kind of relate to both sports in general around the idea of how we help develop better decision makers in the game. I know that you've done a lot of work with John in particular, and you've worked closely with him in the past, and you know, I'm sure you've probably got similar or very very comparable views to John. I just wanted to kind of get your, you know, a bit of background around your philosophy and what you consider to be effective coaching to start with, and then maybe we can kind of tailor from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, John's a good friend and probably one of the most influential mentors in my coaching career and in my life in general. So I definitely hope that I have things in common with him, because that would be a compliment to me. As far as things that I think are essential coaching principles. I do agree that I think those principles transfer between sports. I think they underlie all sports and all teaching. I think whether you're in a classroom or on a sports field, it's the underlying principles of how we're interacting with the people in front of us, our students or our athletes, is the same. I don't think it really should change. And for me, in my program that we run here, the number one tenet, the number one principle that we hold to is joy. Everything we do is to elicit or evoke joy from our athletes, or to allow them to experience joy. That's, to me, the most important thing that we can do as coaches for the athletes that we work with.
Definitely. I think, you know, you talked there about the idea of joy, and I think, you know, a lot of coaches probably would agree that most important thing is for the participants, whether they be youth players or even senior players or athletes, to actually enjoy what they're doing. And it's through that joy that we can, I guess, start to really become more curious and actually learn more. You know, and one of the biggest things that kind of really I've evolved with over the years, you know, since certainly when I first came into the world of coaching, is going from this idea of maybe prescribing a way of working, prescribing maybe particular techniques, prescribing an idealistic view of how I want the game to be played, and obviously the game of football in my case. But as time's gone on, you know, my whole outlook on what coaching is and what it should look like and what my role actually is has changed massively. You know, where I would consider myself as, like I said, quite prescriptive and maybe directive and possibly a very command style coach, you know, that's kind of really transcended its way to where I am today. And, you know, 10 years on, just over 10 years on, I'm now at the stage where I'm probably more, yes, I still have I still place very important emphasis on that technical bit, on what should be done, maybe how it should be done, but I'm probably more focused on around the why. Why are we doing things the way we're doing it? So maybe, you know, for me, it's about helping players develop and raise their awareness around what it is they're doing, first of all, but why. And I like to use the concept of traffic lights. So, you know, the traffic lights analogy for me is almost like you've got your green light moments and you've got your red light moments, and then your ambers are somewhere in between where it's not nailed on, but it could happen. But whilst it's not nailed on, it could also be cut out. So, you know, for me now, it's much more about getting them to become more self-aware about what's happening, the cues around them. And obviously that's led me down this path of, right, I can't really be too much of a command style coach when I do that sort of stuff, because I'm not allowing them the room to, I guess, perceive things for themselves. Because if I'm shouting out instructions, there's only so much of that they're going to take in. And if they're focusing on what I'm telling them, then they're probably less likely to maybe focus on what's actually happening and what they perceive from it themselves. So it's kind of led me down this path where I'm a bit more step back, ask questions. Let's ask them some meaningful questions, and not questions like, oh, how did you find that? Oh, did you enjoy that? For me, it's too surface. I need to get right down to the core of everything that's going on. Did they even see that? So whatever I've seen from the side, I need to be conscious that they might not have seen that. So within that, what have they actually taken on board? I'm sure you've got it in your sport where you've got so many people who are maybe excellent technicians of the game, fantastic at performing. But actually, if you ask them to maybe take a step back and break down what's just happened, they're maybe not always able to. And I don't know, you know, I'm not saying that you necessarily have to be able to break it down, because we've seen some top athletes across many different sports who haven't necessarily been able to transcend themselves into top coaches. Maybe because of that, right. Maybe because they can't quite break it down, and it just becomes an instinctful thing that they've never consciously thought about. But the instinct just, yeah, I have to do this at this moment. And they've got almost those green light moments I talked about on tap. So
right.
I guess, you know, kind of long-winded there, but it'll be interesting to see what your views are on that person, on that sort of, that sort of thing. And we'll just go from there.
Sure. I mean, I'm right there with you. I've not always coached the way I coach now. In fact, I would say it's been an evolution for me over the last 10 years that probably started about 10 years ago. and took me a few years to really nail down what I was looking for in a new coaching philosophy. And I'd say now for probably 5 years, we've really nailed exactly what we're wanting to do. And of course, it still evolves every year, but I think that underlying tenet, the underlying principles haven't really changed in probably 5 to 6 years now. A lot of that is very much what you're talking about the more hands-off approach, the athlete-centered approach rather than the coach-centered approach, where we're putting the athlete and their needs and their desires first and not ours, where we are not prescribing ways to play the game or ways to perform the skills, but we're providing opportunity for them to explore many different ways and to decide themselves upon which ones they're are going to work. And that doesn't mean we just stand and watch and play. We're there to shape the environment, shape their, help them get their attention on the right things, help make sure that they're refining their intention within each action, that they are aware of the different decisions that they can make, and challenging them to explore all the decisions, all the possible actions, rather than just sticking with one that they're comfortable with. I truly believe our number one job as a coach, after making sure that everyone is enjoying themselves, is to challenge themselves, is to challenge them, to challenge them to get outside of their comfort zones, to see things they don't see, to try things they don't try. And to ultimately to fail more so that they can learn faster. And a lot of that, like you said, revolves around asking really good questions. Rather than being a repository of knowledge and having coaching just be, like taking the knowledge that's inside of my head and putting it inside the player's head. I think that's what a lot of coaches think coaching is. And it's certainly what I kind of thought coaching was for many years. If I could just get all of my knowledge about this game into that player's head, they're going to be a good player. And unfortunately, that's really not how learning works. And it's not the best way for us to develop good players or good human beings. I mean, a friend of mine often says, well, if you ask any parents or even a coach, what are we trying to teach these kids when it comes to coaching, and why do kids play sports beyond the actual sport itself? People always tend to come back to some of the lifelong skills that we learn from sports, things like leadership and decision-making and resiliency and all those kind of things. And one of the things I've noticed a lot is, and I know it was true of me for many years, was I was the one making the decisions for the players. I was the one leading them. So how are they getting good at those things if I was doing it all the time? So now that we've switched to more of a model where we are allowing them to make decisions, even if they're the wrong decisions, that's how you learn to make good decisions, is you got to make bad decisions. We're allowing them to be leaders and learn, and we're there to guide them through that process so that they can actually take something away from this sporting experience beyond just the wins and losses of the sport itself, but also move into their lives after sport, or, as they become an adult, that they are good at making decisions and they understand that process and they understand leadership and they understand the learning process, and how to apply that to anything in their life, rather than always looking for some other person to make the decisions for them, to lead them, to motivate them. To me, that is really what we as coaches are responsible to do, is to help these players develop those qualities in themselves. And we do that through this microcosm of youth sports. So.
No, I totally agree with you. And I kind of want to touch on a couple of things you talked, right at the top of that, sorry, you said this use of the word, this phrase, athlete-centered, is certainly becoming a more common thing, at least on the surface level anyway, because people are referring to their development processes and their programs across different sports as athlete centered.
Right.
May not always be the case. I think a lot of people, and you know, it'd be interesting to get your views on this, that a lot of people are mistaken, in my experience, athlete centered and athlete led.
Yeah.
For me, massively different.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you, well, I guess it is what it says on the tin, essentially. Athlete led is athlete led, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily athlete centered either, because if their perception or their understanding of what needs to happen isn't, I guess, clear, or if it does lack clarity, then is it really going to be athlete centered?
I don't know,
but the athlete led part, you know, is one aspect of it, but that athlete centered part, and I think that needs to be kind of really highlighted, that it doesn't mean that the coach doesn't have a say in that, or isn't still orchestrating how that kind of pans itself out, if that makes sense. Do you have a similar kind of view on that? Is that some of the experience that you've had as well? Or?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we get, I don't know what the right word would be. We get people who think that we are creating an environment where the athletes rule the roost, where they're in charge, and we just sit back and watch them play because we say it's athlete centered. And but that's so far from the truth. I mean, the truth is, athlete centered doesn't mean that the adult is not involved. Athlete centered means that the adult is not demanding, demeaning, or diminishing the athlete's experience. It means we are engaging with them as a peer more so than as a fountain of knowledge. And the primary way we do that is through asking great questions that make them think, instead of telling them to do things. So the only thing they really get good at is following instructions. And we want them to learn, not just follow instructions. And we see a lot of, and that was me for 20 years of my coaching career, was I was very good at just telling athletes what to do, and didn't engage them in a way that really motivated them to become great learners. Instead, they were just really great at following directions. Yeah. And if they didn't follow directions, then that meant to me, I hadn't told them clearly enough what to do. So I just needed to tell them more instead of actually provide an opportunity for them to learn, so that they could not only learn what to do in that situation, but adapt their learning to other situations. Because to me, that is the best athlete, is the adaptable athlete, not the one who is really good in one-off situations because they've been told how to handle it.
Yeah.
But the athlete that can adapt to a variety of different things that happen out on the court, and they don't need to look to the coach to figure out how to respond to that. They can figure it out on their own because we've allowed them that autonomy of how to discover the answers for themselves, whether it be individual or the team.
Mm. I think you're spot on there. It just kind of makes me think. So in the delivery of, I guess, a program like that, how does that work in terms of, you know, game related stuff, maybe unopposed practice and opposed practice? And, you know, my view is this, that when it comes to that aspect of things, and I, you know, it'd be interesting to get your perspective from, I guess, from another sport as well. It's not that I don't agree with unopposed practice. And just to kind of clarify what I mean by that is when it's just almost like a shadow play.
Yeah.
Or opposed practice for me, there's obviously it's different variants of that. So you've almost got this dial here where you might just start off with some opposition in as an interference, where they might be just be jockeying their positions, but not actually live to the point where they can actually tackle or anything like that. So that dial there is, for me, how much you go up and down that dial is obviously the important part in terms of how much pressure the players can maybe handle at that moment. But that unopposed part to start with, you know, whereas maybe when I first started got into coaching, I was kind of really almost conditioned in a way to say that, right, we had to go from unopposed, build it up to make it almost finishing with a game-like element to the sessions. Whereas now it's almost like I've completely switched it around now. I'm not specifically saying that I play games, because I do think games are important. I do think they're great. But what I tend to do is I consider it almost zone specific, coaching, in the sense that, and you know, excuse my ignorance because I'm not too familiar with the sport of volleyball itself.
Sure.
And outside of, you know, knowing what the game looks like, mm-hmm. on a surface level, I'm not too sure about the internal components and whatnot. However, just to kind of give you a context, what it might be is I'm working on a particular type of shot from a particular area of the court, in your case, and I'll maybe present different scenarios that could occur in that area of the court. So in my case, it might be right, a pass. I've got the ball. We're in the final third of the field on the right hand side. I'm now gonna maybe put together some what if moments. This could occur. This could occur. And this could occur. And we're gonna just have a couple repetitions of each one. And we're gonna, as a collective between myself and the players, we're gonna discuss why might we use this option. Why might this option occur? Why might this option occur? And there's no guarantees that any of these things are specifically gonna happen. But if we can go based on experience on the types of things we'd expect to see in these areas, then I'm fairly confident that we'll have a good idea of how to maybe deal with them if we come up them against in the game. But not necessarily specifically saying, right, we're going to do this particular thing and we're just going to spend 30 minutes on it. Because I'm very conscious of, you know, the people talk about repetition. Do we ever really get repetitions? No, I'm not sure we actually do. Because there's always going to be some small factor which will change what's actually happening in practice, whether that be because the ball has been paid from 5 yards further left or 5 yards further right. Yes, the context is the same in the overall pattern of what we're trying to achieve. But for me, I don't think you can really, really ever recreate that situation. So I want to expose you to as many potential situations as possible and just give you a bit of experience doing those. So it's almost this idea of, in some ways, you want to become almost like a jack of all trades in that respect. So, you know, what are your views on it? Is that similar to maybe how you work, or do you do it slightly differently? Or
to a degree, I mean, to address a couple of your points there. One on that idea of repetition, I believe it was Bernstein, who's kind of the father of the field of one of the coaching pedagogies that's talked about a lot right now, which is ecological dynamics. I know you had Stuart Armstrong on, and I'm sure he talked about that as he's one of the people who actually helped me find that. And the saying that comes out of that is repetition without repetition, meaning that you are repeating the goal without repeating the how, right? So if you know, in your sport of football, if you're, you know, like you were saying, maybe it's the I don't know the terminology, but it's that third of the field and you're on the right side, and the goal of the activity is to get the ball in the goal, to score a goal. That's why I like football and soccer, is because the terminology is really clear cut. You know, your goal is to make a goal. But you know, if you're trying to, what you're repeating is that goal. How do we make a goal? But you're doing it in a variety of different ways. You're entering the ball differently. You're emphasizing different things. So that's the repetition without repetition. And that, to me, is an essential part of coaching. That concept that you can just repeat the exact same action over and over and over again in order to get better at it, in my opinion, is wrong. Shouldn't be used at any level of the game. And I think the science right now backs that up pretty strongly, in that that concept of blocked training or non-variable practice, those things are, they help you look really good during that one practice, but it doesn't retain, it doesn't stick. And so in the long run, the person is doing more of the variable practice, more of the repetition without repetition, that's the person who's going to get better in the long run. So I think with us, our program is 99.9% game based. Everything we do almost is opposed. We're obviously a net sport, not an invasion game. But there are some similarities between soccer and volleyball. I love it when we have soccer players who come in to try volleyball, because I can actually help them understand our game by relating to soccer. I ask them, how do you score a point in soccer? And they say, well, you kick a ball into the goal. Right. So in volleyball, it's the same thing. You got to get the ball to go into the goal. And they're like, I don't see any goalposts. I don't see a net. I don't see anything that I'm kicking the ball into. I'm like, well, you don't want to necessarily kick it into it. You can, but you can also hit it into it. And the goal just happens to be lying on the floor on the other side of the net. And it's 30 by 30. And you've got six goalkeepers on the other side who are trying to protect you from hitting the ball into that goal. And all of a sudden their eyes kind of light up and they're like, oh, so it is like kind of like soccer. I'm like, yeah, it'd be like soccer if you had a 8-foot net between you and the goal. And you had six people standing in the front of the goal trying to keep you from hitting the ball in there. So now you can maybe understand why in some respects it can be harder. It's certainly not hard. And I'm never going to say volleyball's harder than soccer or either way around. But, when you look at it from that perspective, it can seem a little more difficult. So for us, we're always playing games. Everything's about games, but it's not always the full game, much like in your training. I'm sure you don't always do full-sided games. We break it down. We have one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, four-on-four, six-on-six. Sometimes we'll even go more than, six is the size we play on if we're playing a full-sized match. We might even go up to seven or eight to overload a side. Like I said, 99% of our practices is based on creating a really great game that elicits the behavior that we're looking for. I feel that's the most powerful tool we have as a coach to help an athlete change, is rather than telling them, this is what we want you to do, let's create an activity in which they will discover that thing that we want them to do, or where that thing we want them to do is really maybe the only effective answer. We know that, but we don't tell them that. We let them discover it.
Sure. And just on that then, I'm curious, because, it resonates with my, the way I work a little bit. But I'm also conscious now, whilst we're, we're designing the practice in a way where it obviously, like you said, certain outcomes are going to be probably more favored than others. And in some cases, maybe the only potential outcome. If we've designed it in a way where it could be the only potential outcome, are we now manufacturing success, firstly? And secondly, are we not in danger of limiting their creativity outside of that option that they've deemed, okay, this works?
Yes, to answer your question. Yes, I agree. I mean, we would never create a game where there's only one possible solution, other than the solutions within the rules of the game. Like, you wouldn't create a training activity in your sport in which if you miss the goal, you got a point, because that's, what are you teaching them, right? So you are manufacturing one right answer, which is get the ball into the goal.
Sure.
But that's the rules. That's within the rules of the game, which to me are, that's the most fundamental aspect of any game, are the rules. That's our first constraints that we have to be held to. And you should try to hold your players to the constraints of the rules most of the time. I think sometimes it's okay to explore outside of the rules. In our game, volleyball has some very unique aspects to it that make it difficult for younger players to learn, because it's a rebound game. It's played at the speed of physics and gravity. You can't stop the ball. You can't, I'll probably continue to say soccer, but I think you understand. I mean football or soccer, but in soccer, a young player, when a ball comes to them, can stop the ball, make a decision, move on. In basketball, catch the ball, make a decision, move on. Sports like volleyball, tennis, table tennis, badminton, they're all rebound sports where the decisions have to be made at the speed of the ball. Mm. And so for younger players, because their cognitive ability to make decisions isn't there, they don't have enough experience yet. So it's really hard for them to make decisions. So it's just reaction. There's no decisions. They're just reacting all the time. So like for us, with a lot of our younger players, we'll allow them to catch one of, you know, volleyball, we get three contacts on our side of the net. We'll allow them to catch one of those three contacts. So maybe they catch the first one, and then they have to abide by the rules of the game for the next two contacts. But it slows it down enough that we can start talking to them about making decisions and allow them to think about the next thing they're going to do, which if you just always held them to the rules of the game at that level of play, I feel like a lot of the kids would be very frustrated and never learn because they can never figure out what to do. And so I do think that we do need to manipulate the rules at times in order to create a game that is just barely hard for the player, but not too hard for the player. Because I think when we get too challenging, it can be when there's no success, that's when the motivation quickly goes away for players. But so, you know, back to the point being that I think that you always got to just start with the rules of the game and what do the rules say. But then within those rules, be creative about how to elicit change from your players. So like if I was wanting my players to hit the ball over the net in a specific way or to a specific place, rather than say that's the only thing you're allowed to do, or rather than say that's the only way you can score a point, I might just say you get bonus points if you do it that way. So you're going to still score all the other ways that are out there and you're welcome to explore them. But if you want that, you know, rather than 1 point, maybe we'll give you 5 points if you do it this specific way. So now the athlete, if the athlete's not in position to do it that way, they don't have to. They can still score another way. But if they're in position to go for that one, the thing that we're trying to work on that day, then it incentivizes them to actually go for that rather than fall back on what they know.
So just on that then, you know, if they're now getting to that point where they're maybe going for it in a certain way, whichever way that may be, whether it's the one that you kind of want to direct them to or elsewhere, at any stage in that process or at any stage of together, do you actually then have a conversation with them around maybe why they picked that method potentially? What were potentially the key maybe variables within that they might have to be aware of to maybe make a better decision as to whether that method is probably the best appropriate method in that situation, if you get what I mean.
Absolutely. Yeah. We do have conversations with our players about the 60-foot view of our game, looking down from above, imagining what the court looks like, imagining where everybody's at, why are we making these decisions that we're making? But I do think it's really important for coaches to recognize that there is a huge difference between knowledge of the game and knowledge in the game. Hmm. You got TV analysts out there who have a massive knowledge of the game and they could tell you exactly what should have happened, but those people can't necessarily walk out on the field or out onto the court and actually make that same correct decision in the game. Sure. And like you referred to earlier, you have players who can do make amazing decisions on the field or on the court, but if you ask them to actually explain why, they're going to be like, I have no idea, like, you know, it's just what happened.
If you've got those players who can make those decisions, what are your thoughts? Do you think it's important for them to understand the why? I mean, obviously at the end of the day they get the result, but in order to kind of make them potentially build on it and take it to maybe the next level, is it important for them to understand why? My view is that the more we know, the more we can try and recreate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I do think, they work together. I think having players that are intelligent about the game, they have a knowledge of the game, Those are the players that can learn from more sources. You know, like they can watch a match on YouTube and learn. They can watch another team in the same space they're in, or they can watch a teammate and they can assess that. They can assess themselves. You know, they can watch a video of themselves and learn from it. But the player who only has knowledge in the game and only has that experiential knowledge, I think struggles to learn from anything that isn't actually playing the game. Mm-hmm. And so I think helping increase their, that third person view of their playing definitely helps to increase the rate at which they can learn, because they can just assess themselves after each play, or they can have a little bit better opportunity to reflect on the decisions that they've made, why that didn't work, what could have worked better, instead of always having it come down to the microsecond in which they're doing it and hoping that they've somehow accrued enough knowledge to make the right play, you know? So I do think, you know, like if you tell a player there's a specific spot out on the court that's open and that they agree with it, and they're able to work on hitting that because they understand the tactical advantage of that, I think that's an essential part of the game. But I also think there's a lot of, you know, the coupling between the perception and the action that's going on. And sometimes if you were to ask an athlete, why did you do that? They don't know. It was just the experiential knowledge that took the perception, coupled it with an action, and that thing happened. And you know, that old saying, your actions speak louder than your words. I've gotten to a point now where I'm trying more and more with the athletes I work with to, instead of having a conversation with them, have a quick, you know, points made, but then say, okay, now go show me. Instead of explain this to me, I don't care if you can explain it to me. I need you to be able to show it to me, because this is a sport in which we do things. It's not a sport in which we talk about things. Sure. And so I think that it is important. It's more important for the athlete to be able to do the stuff than it is for them to be able to explain it. Do I think being able to explain it can enhance their ability to do it? Yes. But I will always put the action as more important than the ability to verbalize. Because I have a lot of really smart athletes who are extremely intelligent, and they're going to tell me what I want to hear, whether or not they can do it, whether or not they even know that's what they should do when they're out on the court. They're going to tell me that that's, you know, that they know those things. And but then you say, okay, now go show me. Yeah. And they go out there and they don't do any of it because there's no crossover there. And so I think it's, when I'm going to assess an athlete, I'm going to assess an athlete based on what they do, not on what they tell me.
Mm. I think, you know, it's an interesting point you make there. I think my only thing would be is in that process of them maybe not being able to explain it, that if they are able to explain it, yes, they might not necessarily be able to perform it, because obviously that's, you're right, it's a doing, it's an action. However, if they're aware of maybe what the process could potentially look like in order to get some more success, then potentially more likely to be able to, I guess, implement it, if that makes sense. You know, kind of just, you know, I want to take you back to something you touched on earlier around obviously being an athlete-centered program. And obviously, you know, you kind of said that you're very similar in the sense that you take a bit of a hands-off approach. Is there specific questions or, I guess, bits of information that you might want from your players before deciding on which path to take them down?
In what way are you referring to?
So in terms of, obviously, you know, we talked earlier about this idea of being athlete-centered. Mm-hmm. Is it important for you in any way? And if so, how do you go about obtaining the information around what they already perceive to know about a particular context. I'm quite interested in one of the things that, you know, I've heard you discuss in the past around the idea of maybe not so much looking at the action itself, but maybe the efficiency of the action.
Okay. Yeah, I think, there are definitely important things to know about each athlete in front of you. I think knowing their goals, that's super important. You know, instead of making our goals as the coach central to what's going on, we need to make sure that we know what their goals are. What are your goals out of being on this team this year? You know, if I have a player who just wants to be hanging out with friends and playing a sport they enjoy and that's their goal, then I probably shouldn't be like treating them as if their goal is to play collegiate volleyball. And I shouldn't be holding them to the standards that are going to be necessary in order to do that. Whereas if I have a player who has said it very expressly to me, my goal is to play Division I college volleyball in the United States, then my interaction with that player is going to be different than the other player, because I'm here to help that player achieve that goal. And if I don't change the way I interact with an athlete based on their goals, and I interact with everybody the same, I'm probably not helping anybody. So I do think one critical piece of knowledge for each athlete is to know what are your goals? Why are you here? You know, your why. Why are you playing volleyball? Is it just because you love it and you hang out with friends? Is it because you want to make your high school varsity team? Is it because you want to, your mom played and she's making you be here? Is it because you want to be the next international superstar? All of those things are, that's super important. I think knowing what's going on in the player's life is important. What levels of stress are they under when they walk into the gym? What's going on in their life? Is it,
I think you hit the mute button.
That was my fault. did they just take 5 huge tests today and their brain is fried and they're walking into the gym? And I need to know those things, and what good things happened to them today? You know, like one of my favorite questions that I've started asking all of, I coach one team in my program. So I have 10 athletes I'm their coach. And when they come in the gym, I walk up to each one of them. I say, what's the best thing that happened to you today? And, you know, and unfortunately, which I think is very interesting, most of them can't answer. Like, they're like, can I get back to you on that? And I, cause they're not used to being asked those kind of questions.
You know, for a lot of, sometimes I find myself asking questions of players, and I find that often they don't have an answer because they've never really had, they've never been asked that question.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really fascinating to me. Like, you know, we've been asking that. We've been asking, like, what are you most grateful for today? And those, they're so used to the adults in their lives being deficit detectors instead of, you know, strength finders. And that's a concept I got from motivational interviewing, which is a pretty fascinating area of work that I think vastly applies to coaching. And the guy that basically invented motivational interviewing wrote a book on how to apply it to sports. I can't remember his name at the moment, but I have his book, and I know that that's one of his terms, is that deficit detector. And I really like that as the description of what I don't want to do. I don't want to be the adult who's constantly just finding where you're unworthy and what needs to be fixed. But I want to be able to point out to my athletes what their strengths are. What are the good things? What are you, and I want them to be able to do that on their own. That's why I ask, like, what was the greatest thing that happened to you today? You know?
And I think you make a fantastic point, because I think it quite often, and I talked earlier about, you know, the transition in terms of the way I coach, and where I used to be quite directive and maybe not asking the athletes for too much of their opinions and their thoughts on things. I found that obviously over time, as I started to do that, and I still kind of get it now, when I maybe potentially enter a new environment, or you know, even outside of the coaching world, really, and some of the stuff I do is around coach education. So I deliver courses and things like that, and trainings. And even when I'm, you know, in that environment, I almost take a similar approach. I want to know, well, actually, let me ask more questions that know where you're at. Because if I know where you're at, I know where I can take you next on the journey, or where, or which direction I need to maybe guide or lead you in. But obviously, you know, I think human instinct is almost, you're asking me a question, are you trying to catch me out?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that, I'm not sure that's human instinct. I think that's a cultural creation.
Sure.
You know, I think it's something because that's what most kids have experienced when they're in with adults, is that when an adult.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ask the questions. One of my favorite things to do is when a player does something exactly the way we would want them to, and you say to them, why'd you do that way? Or how did that feel? And they immediately go on the defensive, like, oh, did I mess it up? And you're like, just because I'm asking you about it doesn't mean you did anything wrong. You know, but they're so accustomed to that. That's when, you know, adults, parents, coaches, teachers, they don't ask you questions unless there's something wrong. And
I think something that's helped me with that is that when I've maybe had someone maybe performed a good pass or whatever it might be, I start that interaction off with, Lauren, I love the way that you did. Can you now tell me what made you do that?
Right.
And I find that straight away that breaks that barrier.
Yes.
I've got the praise. I don't even need to put my guard up anymore. Let me just ask the question comes next. And, you know, sorry to cut you there, but you know, I think it's a great point.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's funny you brought that up, because that's another thing that I've been working on. We've just this year, one of our goals has been to, coming again from this motivational interviewing research that I've done, is to distinguish pretty clearly in our own verbiage to our athletes, the difference between praise and affirmation. Because praise, as the gentleman who wrote the book and invented this idea of motivational interviewing, which if you're not familiar with it, it's used mostly to create change in people who are addicted to things. And it's very powerful and it's very successful. And now he's trying to help coaches see how they can apply this into the realm of coaching, because that's what we're trying to do every day, is get people to buy into change. And but anyway, one of his points is that praise and affirmation are very different. Praise is something you can take away. And I do it all the time. Kids do something and I'm like, oh, I love that. That was so awesome. You know, but then I realize, what about the next one? If I don't say that on the next one, does that mean they're not awesome anymore? Does it mean I don't love it?
Yeah.
You know, and how it, you know, it can be taken away. Like in our sport, one of the number one things people do is we serve, right? Yeah. So we serve the ball over the net. So if I have a player who hits a serve and I'm like, oh, I love that serve. What about the next one?
I think that's where the idea of being specific with what it is about that serve or that pass or that movement that you did really like, because, you know, it's interesting. I'm a bit slightly out, a bit off topic, but there was a conversation over, you know, talking with some pundits who were analyzing a game on the TV, and they talked about this idea of they've got to be very careful when they in commentary where the words that they use, because you know, I guess in my world, you've got the likes of Lionel Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo. And if they do something that was outstanding, can they now go and say the same for maybe someone that, you know, isn't Cristiano Ronaldo, Messi, to say, oh, that person just did something that was outstanding? Now, it's all relative in some ways. However, I've just said this was outstanding because Messi and Ronaldo just did something that was truly outstanding. And I've said this was outstanding here because it was something that was done well and it looked in that context outstanding. But then I guess it depends on the environment, how they actually define that word.
Yeah.
Outstanding, if you take it as, you know, literally what it says on the tin, it's something that stood out.
Right.
If you're now comparing it, you use it in those words too much, then they start to maybe lose their value and the credibility behind what you're saying. So I think it's very important in that respect to say, do you know what? It's almost like, you know, when you use the sandwich technique for the feedback stuff, you know, you give the positive, the negative, and you add the positive back in. So, you know, I love the way you did this, but this is how maybe we could improve it. But it really worked well because of that, or you know what I mean? And I think that's where you can maybe kind of break it down a little bit more for some of the athletes and players to kind of take on board. And I think for me, that's definitely worked for me. Whereas I guess in my role as a coach and as a coach educator, I see so many coaches constantly, well done, well done, well done, giving all the praise in the world. And then, you know, the one question I always ask them is, right, you've now gone and said well done to that person over there. Maybe in the last 60 minutes, you probably said it about 30, 40 times.
Yeah.
Maybe more. If I went and spoke to that person now and asked them what they actually did well, would they be able to?
They would have no idea. Yeah.
The chances they probably won't, because you haven't been specific. So if you're going to be praising someone, and I totally get what you're saying about around the affirmation and the praise part, it's a great point, because just because I'm affirming you doesn't mean everything is going to be good now. Just because I've praised you doesn't mean everything is good now. There's still going to be things you need to work on. And just because you weren't as good in this moment doesn't mean that the next time you do it, I still didn't enjoy it. But I think this is where the consistency needs to come into play. And like you said, just because you did a great serve this time around, if you do the same thing next time, and I'm still going to be impressed with it. But I think that's where it becomes more key and specific to highlight.
Yeah.
What was it about that serve, or what was it about that pass, or whatever it is that I actually thought you did really well with?
Yeah.
And then maybe challenge the player. So in this case, it might be, right, Lauren, I love the way you serve that ball. You know, I think the way you pop the ball up before you actually, you know, you actually put, you know, put your follow through on it was fantastic. If we can recreate that, however, you might want to work a little bit on this part of it, but that bit there, really stick to kind of getting that as often as you can. And straight away, I think that gives a reference point for the athlete or the player to kind of think about and say, okay, cool, coach, you know, he might praise me a lot, but he's very specific about what he's praising me with. So now I think, you know, my experience tells me that you're more likely to maybe want to absorb that and retain that than anything else, because I've given you specificity rather than, yeah, this guy's always telling me well done, but I don't actually know what I'm doing well.
Yeah, totally. I agree. I mean, I think anytime we're given feedback to a player, the more specific we can be, the better it's going to be, the more specific to the things they can control. You know, the better it's going to be. The big difference that we've found to be really cool between praise versus affirmation is, if you look at praise as simply a recognition of something done well, affirmation is more of a recognition of an innate quality that allows you to do things well. And so instead of saying, I really liked that serve, you would say something like, you have such an intense focus, it allows you to serve really well. That's an affirmation. That's pointing out a innate quality in that athlete, pointing out a strength that they have that they can then rely on in the future. And they don't need us to point it out every time because it's part of who they are. And that was the point from the motivational interviewing that I really thought was fascinating. Instead of focusing so much on outcomes or on technique and praising those things and finding good things to praise and finding deficits to detect and talk about, spend more time on affirming qualities within those athletes that are qualities that all of these other things are built on. You know, you put 100% effort every time you go for the ball. You know, that's an affirmation. That's telling that athlete, every time you do this, I recognize that you put 100% of yourself into it, and how that then affects an athlete's perception of themselves and their motivation, I think is pretty awesome. And I think that's when you can get an athlete to start talking about change. When you're able to get them to recognize that they have innate qualities that allow them to do things well and to change. So they start believing in their ability to change, you know, instead of just one off, hey, that was a great serve. That one wasn't, that one was, that one wasn't, that one was, or you did this technical thing really well there, but you didn't there. Oh, you didn't do it again. Oh, you just did it great this time. That's all in the coach's perspective. So then we become the limit of a player's ability, because everything we're talking about is from our third person perspective of them doing it, instead of pointing out innate qualities that that athlete has, regardless of my involvement. And then they can rely on those innate qualities to support themselves, and they don't need us as much. If an athlete truly believes that they give 100% to get to every ball, because we've affirmed them of that on multiple occasions, and then they become to believe it, then they don't need us to say, I love, that was great effort for that ball. That wasn't, that one was, that wasn't, that one was. They just know they're going for every ball, and then they start to change. I think that's a really powerful tool that not enough coaches know about. I didn't know about it. Not only know about, but also are willing to explore. It's kind of hard. I've been trying it for about 3 months now on a pretty regular basis. I catch myself in the middle of praise, and I say, okay, I don't want to say something to this athlete that on the very next play I might take back. So what could I say to this athlete that would last for the rest of today and the rest of forever, that they then can grab a hold of as a foundational belief in themselves that helps them show up in this gym and become better and more authentic to who they are. If I can do that for them, that's a whole lot more than simply correcting technique or giving them some tactic. You know, that's helping change them at the fundamental human level and their fundamental belief in themselves. And then it really becomes, I'm making myself ultimately unimportant.
Yeah.
You know, I know a lot of coaches really struggle with this idea, but I really believe our job as a coach is to, down the line somewhere, make us irrelevant.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think for me, it's that I always said, you know, my number one job as a coach, if I'm able to achieve it, is to become redundant in the environment. And you know, almost put myself in a position where I'm in an environment, not because I'm then needed by the players, but wanted by the players.
Yeah.
And you know, that kind of falls in line with one of the other, I guess, the main principles for how I work, in that I want to become a coach who can help players become. And this is an interesting one that I've been having on and off conversations with many people about the idea of independent athletes. I'm not sure if I want my players to become fully independent, but I certainly want them to become interdependent.
That's a good point.
If they're interdependent, I feel that definition of that term for me leaves room for them to, I guess, still want to maybe interact with me around some of the ideas that they've got in their minds, some of the concepts that they might be struggling with or wanting to build on, and just having those conversations. Because, you know, I'm sure it's the same for you, but, you know, many sports now have gone very far away from this idea of a technical coach to now maybe a holistic aspect of development or across the board. And I think a large part of that is that social interaction and that confidence in I guess, ultimately leading to interdependence between yourself and the athlete as the coach, so yourself as a coach and the athlete and the coach, obviously the athlete and yourself as a coach. So I think, you know, that piece is really important to me. But I kind of wanted to touch on one of the last bits that you talked about there about, you know, it might not be specific if you, your role there to now then just be there to give technical and tactical information. So off the back of that, you know, I know one of the things that you've talked about in the past is, you know, these principles that you work within, I guess, the way you, you know, you may coach the technical elements. Would you mind just maybe going into a little bit more of detail around that and sharing what your, I guess, your principles are in that respect?
Yeah, I think I know what you're referring to. So, you know, we don't really teach the technical elements very much in our gym. Volleyball is, you ask anybody who's coached volleyball and they're going to tell you volleyball is a technical sport. The fundamentals of volleyball are the techniques. That's the common phrase. I don't believe so. I believe that the fundamentals of our sport, or the fundamental of our sport, is the interactions between the people involved. That you can't say something is fundamental if it can be done multiple different ways. You know, the fundamentals of passing a volleyball or of spiking a volleyball. Well, there's about 30 different ways to teach both. So how is it fundamental? You know, to me, the fundamentals of volleyball are the rules and the interactions between the players and possibly the coach as well, and the opponents, all those interactions that are going on. So when it comes to technique, our first thing that we always talk about when it comes to the action between the player and the ball is, what is it? What's the outcome? What do you want to have happen? You know, in our game, if you take defense, for instance, somebody on the other side of the net is hitting a ball at 65 miles an hour over a net, and you're trying to dig it. You're trying to keep it off the ground and get it up in the air. So where is it that we're trying to get that ball to go? That's, to me, the most important thing, not how you do it, but where is it going? If you are the setter, so the setter is the one who usually contacts the ball second on your side of the net and literally sets the ball up for an attacker to spike it. To me, the most important thing when the setter is setting the ball is, where does the ball go? Because that's what allows the spiker to attack the ball, not how you do it. Our sport, you said earlier that there is this move in a lot of sports to move away from this technical model into more of a holistic model. My experience is not in volleyball. In volleyball, it is still ruled by the technical coach. It is very much still, you go into the vast majority of gyms around, at least in the United States, and there is going to be more feedback given on technique than on anything else. And that's where I was there for sure for many years. And that's the big change that I've made, is to get away from telling kids how to do things, how to correct things. Again, that deficit detector, or the other term that is used for that is the writing reflex. So writing is in R-I-G-H, not W-R. But so the writing reflex, oh, they did something wrong. My reflex as a coach then is to jump in and tell them how to do it right. Instead, it's about, what is the outcome of your contact on the ball? Did that ball go where we wanted it to go? Great. Now, maybe we're going to have a conversation about how you can make that more consistent, you know, and if, again, we get soccer players who come in here to play our game, and they might react to pass the ball with their foot. Because they couldn't get to it with their arms. And so they use their foot and it goes right where it's supposed to. And I'll be like, that's awesome. It went right where it's supposed to. But do you think that that's the most consistent and effective way to do this in the sport of volleyball? You know, and so that's the first place that we have a conversation that is somewhat technique oriented, is we need to get the ball to this place. What's, I want you to explore ways to do that. And the reality is, at least in our sport, and I think it's true of every other sport, is that if the goal, if a player's attention is on the right thing and their intention is in line with the intention of the team and they're making great decisions, they're going to look a lot like what perfect technique might look like without us teaching them perfect technique. You know, and so we don't really have this concept of perfect technique. We don't have it at all. I wouldn't even hedge my bet on that one. We just don't even talk about it in our gym.
It's interesting because just on that, you know, I want to take you back a few seconds. You talked there about this concept of perfect technique, and you know, something that you said right at the start of that was this idea that there could be 30 or maybe an infinite amount of different types of techniques that could be used for a one simple technical component, shall we say. But a lot of that obviously is heavily impacted on the context of each given situation. So this technique might be better if, for whatever reason, the player is slightly off balance or whatever, all these different, you know, these different variables that might exist. And, you know, but I think the key part is that there can be many successful techniques and, you know, many ways to skin that cat. You know, people always say to me, well, how come you don't really give your players a lot of technical information anymore? And I'm thinking, well, it's not that I don't give technical information anymore, but I want to challenge them to maybe find out what works for them and yes, what they find effective. And, you know, some of the ways in which I go about doing that is asking them maybe specific questions and really try and get them attuned to how maybe they're feeling in a moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe paying attention to, does it feel right? Because I'm conscious that, and I always go back to this one experience I had a few years ago where for a brief time I was working with goalkeepers in the game, and I had about 6 goalkeepers from 4 different countries, and none of them were maybe performing or getting the outcome in the way that I would potentially want. I would have coached it to be, achieved. And I guess that was the first kind of time where I almost took a step back and hold on a second. They're all getting success here. No one's actually failing here. Obviously, it's not, you know, it can always be better, but they're getting relative success. But none of them are doing it the way I would want them to do it or coach them. Right. So is it that they're wrong or I'm wrong? Well, not actually. There's just many ways to skin this cat. What can I learn from that? So I then took more of an opportunity to maybe start to study and assess their technique, what made them different. As maybe, you know, some of them might have been smaller, taller, quicker, faster, the rest of them, all these different variables to start trying to assess and, evaluate, right, why would that person use that technique? Is it a cultural thing from where they're from, potentially? Is it because this technique, although it is cultural, is that technique maybe more beneficial for someone who's smaller and more agile, potentially? And, you know, just these are the sorts of questions I started asking myself. And what I ended up with is, you know, coming right back to the top of the conversation, it wasn't me trading my apple with theirs. It was me and them exchanging different ways of working. So now I've gone from having one way of doing it to I've got now 7 different ways of doing this.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a concept within that realm that I mentioned earlier of ecological dynamics, which feeds into the constraints led approach of coaching. There's a concept within that it's not just within coaching, it's within ecology itself. That's called degeneracy. And this was one that took me a while to wrap my head around. But once I really understood what degeneracy was within this context, it's powerful to me. And degeneracy is basically what you said. There's many ways to skin a cat, in that when we look at anything in nature, there is always going to be multiple ways to achieve the same goal. And you look at something as simple as like a bacteria, or, I mean, I hate to use this term right now, but as simple as a virus, even at the simple level, they will achieve their goals through many different means and not through just one specific technique, you know? And that, so this idea that is that degeneracy used to be, by many of the researchers, they saw there's one right way and everything else, all those other ways that you were seeing in those goalkeepers, those were all, that was all noise that we have to prune away so we can get to that one right way. But now what we're understanding is that degeneracy is a good thing, and that there isn't one right way. There's the way that works right now in this moment. And if you have, if you're an adaptable athlete who understands there's multiple different ways to achieve the same goal, then you're going to be more successful in the in a variety of different situations. So if you're a goalkeeper, I have, again, I'll probably show my limited knowledge of the game here, but you know, if I'm a goalkeeper and I'm having to face off against a guy who's getting a free kick, right? So a penalty kick. If I read him correctly and I make my move to the left and he kicks the ball to my left, what I end up doing is going to be very different than if I read him incorrectly and I started to go to my right and then he kicked to his left or kicks to my left. You know, so we need to be able to help athletes become adaptable and not prescribe them a technique, one technique for each little possible situation, because we can't predict all of the possible situations.
It's interesting because, just, you know, as you're talking, I guess another experience just popped up for me, and it's this, coming back to what you said earlier about, you know, getting them to come up with different ways and creative different ways of, I guess, dealing with an obstacle, shall we say. And I've actually been in a situation, now that I think about it, I've actually said to a player, okay, well, you've done that really well. I like the way you did that. But now I'm going to challenge you. Can you come up with another way of dealing with it?
Yes. Yeah, that's such a powerful question to ask an athlete.
And it's interesting because when you mentioned earlier, this was, I wanted to come back to this as well, but the idea of creating different ways of, I guess, dealing with, I'm going to call it an obstacle rather than a problem. Do you find yourself asking them any particular questions? Because, and it kind of brings it back to what I was saying earlier on, in that I'm very conscious about wanting to know whether the players can actually, and you're right, it's maybe not so much important for them to be able to explain it per se, but if I can, especially not in an articulate way anyway, but more so if I can gauge what they're actually perceiving as potential indicators or variables to kind of work off that might impact their performance or their action, then I know I'm on the right track, and I'm closer to understanding what they're actually taking on board. So in the process of them coming up with different ways, is there any particular question or line of question that you go down to find out, right, why have you gone in this direction with it?
I mean, I think it's context dependent, depending on what it is they're doing on the court. You know, I do think that it's really powerful to allow the game to ask the questions instead of the coach. Not that we don't ask questions, we definitely do, but one of the best explanations of the whole idea of ecological dynamics in coaching that was ever given to me was to just envision that the game and the opponent are posing problems, asking questions of you. How are you going to respond? And so, and then my dad taught me that if you ask a question and you don't like the answer you got, ask a better question. And so to me, that then means if we've created a game and this player is not responding in the way that we were hoping to, instead of saying to the player, hey, you're supposed to do this, we create a better game that asks a better player of the question of the of the player, so that they respond in a better way or in another way. It doesn't necessarily mean there's better, there's just different, right? And so I think that, again, though, that's one way. There's certainly a place for coaches to ask direct questions. And I think there's a place for coaches to tell. I don't think there's anything wrong in certain circumstances for coaches to simply tell. You know, one conversation I've had with a lot of coaches is, if all we ever do is sit back and ask questions, We're making that player go through the evolution of our sport from the day it was invented until now. You know, we need them to be able to benefit from, in our sport, the 200 years of our sport prior to their birth.
Yeah.
So that they can build on it. So it's okay to tell them, this is how we do this in our game.
Sure.
If, you know, we've discovered for 200 years of playing this game that if you want to serve effectively, these are some things you want to keep in mind. I want you to go and explore that idea and figure out how to make that work for you.
I'm not thinking back to my own practice. You know, when you're talking about, you know, times where we can tell them now, that has changed dramatically for me over the years in terms of where I was used to be. Like every time's a time for me to tell you what to do because I'm the coach.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, actually, those questions that I'm asking and wanting to be aware of whether you've understood a particular context or what you're being aware of, what you're paying attention to within a given moment, or I guess those variables that I talked about earlier, is that for me is creating a platform or a reference point for me to kind of come back to tell you, Lauren, remember when we talked about this? You told me
Yeah.
This is the time for that.
Right.
So that for me, that's kind of, I guess, the reason why I go down that pathway of or that line of questioning, to kind of create that reference point for us to kind of come back to. So if it is now potentially in a game context where we can't openly have that conversation now, Lauren, remember what we spoke about last Friday around this? Remember what we said? This is what we said we're going to do, and this is the reason why. So it's almost like, boom, okay, light bulb moment. And we kind of crack on from it there.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a really important thing to recognize about, you know, again, the people I work with, the players I work with are primarily kids. I think it is true of almost all human beings anyway, that one of the number one things human beings want is to be seen and not judged, right? We want to be seen, but not judged. And what do we as coaches typically do for the vast majority of the time a kid's in front of us? Or how do they perceive what we're doing? It's judging them.
Yeah, 100%. It comes back to that aspect of asking that question in the first place. And they think, ooh, this is
right. So I think an important thing to get across to our players through how we say things is that when I'm telling you something, it's just facts. It's not judgment. So instead of telling you, you know, there's all kinds of different things that pop into my head there. But an example to me of facts would be like in my sport, defining the outcome of an action, the desired outcome of an action, so clearly that then I can share with the player whether they achieved that outcome or not. And it's not my judgment. It's an agreed upon definition we have as a team. So maybe, I don't know if this will be hard to understand since you're not really into volleyball, but when we run offense in our sport, the height of the set, so that second contact where the setter is setting the ball up for the hitter, the height of that set kind of dictates the speed of your offense, right? The lower the set, the faster you're attacking the other team, the higher the set, the more time the other team has to ready their defense against you. And we as a program really like to be faster on our attack than rely on the natural athleticism of an athlete. Just put the ball up super high and let this big jumper go up there and hit it. The other team's ready, but they're not going to stop them anyway. We don't get a lot of those kind of athletes. So we want to be able to maximize what we do have. And we do that by trying to speed things up. So we have a pretty well-defined height of the set. And we share that at the beginning of the season. And we help them understand why that's important. And we get them to agree that they're going to work on that. And so then when my setter is setting the ball, I can simply say to her, that was too high. That was too low. It's not judgment. It's just facts. And she doesn't hear it as judgment because we've defined it. And I will tell her, hey, I'm going to let you know whether you're setting it at the height that we've agreed upon. Is that okay? And she, of course, she wants that feedback. She wants facts. She wants to know, is it too high? Is it too low? So I'm going to share that with her. And that's just me telling. I'm not asking questions. I'm just telling her, hey, that was too high. That was too low. That was too wide. That was too close to the net. That was too far off the net. That's all just, that's like I'm taking out a ruler and just measuring things for her. So those are things where I really feel like facts are things kids cherish when you share them with them. They want those, you know. It's when we instill our judgment and they hear it as simply judgment that I think we can lose them. You know, I think the height of that set was too high. Without having necessarily defined it beforehand. Like if I didn't tell the kid what, if we didn't agree together on how high a set to our outside left side hitter was supposed to be, and we didn't have this agreed upon reality for our team. And I just, on the very first day they were with me, they set a ball and I was like, that's too high. Then they hear judgment. There's not facts. Mm. And so, and I gave them fat. I gave them judgment without any help on how to change it. And so that telling doesn't do anybody any good. So I think it's important that when you do, I think there is a place for telling. I also think there's a place for telling when it comes to holding them to their own, to the things they've agreed to do. You know, a kid is, you know, their behavior or whatever they've agreed upon as a team. These are unacceptable behaviors. You know, we do that with all of our teams at the beginning of the year. What's acceptable behavior and what's unacceptable behavior? And when a kid starts to act in that unacceptable way, I don't go asking them questions. I tell them, hey, you remember, we agreed, this is unacceptable. And they're like, oh, you're right. Okay, sorry, I'm back to acceptable. I'm going to work on that. My bad. Or we might have a longer discussion that lasts for weeks where that kid is struggling with the way they interact with their teammates or whatever. But those are times where I think we have to be willing to just tell. And especially as you know, in your sport and mine, we're all under a time constraint. Right. You only got so much time with these kids. You know, I get them for 5 months and then I might not ever see them again, but they definitely, I'm not their next coach because they're going to go off to school and they're going to go play for their school. And a lot of them play for us in order to make their school teams. And there's certain things they need to know and learn from us before they go off to school. And so within that time constraint, I got to make sure those players get what they're paying for out of my program. And sometimes just telling a kid, this is the answer, is going to speed along that process so that they get to where they need to be in that 5 months time, rather than me saying, well, you know what, why don't you just explore for the next 5 months? And who knows if you're actually going to find the answer or not by then. You know, one analogy that I loved with it was like, you know, my team is like an island in the middle of the ocean. And I've invited these players to come to this island. And I know where the big pot of gold is that's buried in a cave in the middle of the island. But I can tell those players, hey, why don't you guys go explore for a while and see if you can find it? And then you only have 5 months on the island. And if none of you find the pot of gold in that 5 months, too bad, you're going back to the mainlands with no gold. Or I could be like, you know what, let me go show you where that pot of gold is so we can get off of that pot of gold and actually start exploring the beaches and the jungles and go and see some of the cool animals that are here too. You know, so I think there is a place for that time when we can give direct instruction to players. But I think when we rely on that as our main mode of teaching, that's when we're failing them. I think we need to rely on allowing them to explore, allowing them to create, allowing them to, you know, to just look around on that island on their own for a while and see what they can come up with. I think that's not done enough. And I think it's really, really important.
You make some fantastic points. And I think it is identifying the right time, when to step in, when to not step in. I think, and obviously over time, using experience to say, how long is this going to take? And I think it is, for me, certainly from my experience, would tell me that those ongoing conversations I'm having with them will kind of give me an idea of, again, how far they maybe are from finding that goal or finding that treasure in the middle of the island, as you say, but also what routes they've considered taking on the way to getting there in the first place. And it's almost like that, it's a game of hot and cold. You're getting hotter here, you're getting hotter, you're getting hotter, maybe not, try again, sort of thing. And, you know, you were hotter here, but you know, you're getting moving a little bit further away from this. Let's try and stay in that realm without kind of, it's here, do you know what I mean? So
yeah,
that's definitely a good way of kind of, I guess, looking at it. And look, I think there's a couple key things to me in it from this conversation so far, is that it's got to be athlete centered. And obviously, you know, the thing I talked about right at the top of the start of this, where we talk about it's not necessarily athlete led, but athlete centered. Mm-hmm. The coach still kind of oversees that program or that process. Certainly more so, even if it is in collaboration with the athlete. And I think that part's key for me as well. And, you know, certainly allowing or encouraging them to make and come up with their own different ways of working problems out or overcoming obstacles. And it's not to say that the ways they're using currently aren't effective, but the more ways they can come up with, I guess the more tools they've got when the nuts and bolts are in front of them, so to speak. So I think, I'm sure that Lauren, I've had a really enjoyable conversation so far. And I'm sure we could go on for hours and hours about different aspects of the ecological dynamics, the motivational interviewing. Is something that I've recently kind of stumbled on myself and I'm starting to look into a little bit myself. But I'm conscious of time. And, you know, it might be room for a part two potentially, but just off the back of the conversation we have had today, you know, if there's any listeners or viewers out there that maybe wanted to kind of learn a little bit more about yourself, the work that you do, or some of the concepts that we've discussed in this conversation, is there somewhere they can get in touch with you to do that?
Sure. Probably the most succinct way to get in touch with me would be Twitter, which is just @RiseVolleyball. I'm on there a lot. I don't post a lot. I repost a lot of stuff that I see in the coaching world. If anybody was to reach out to me on there, I definitely would be able to connect with them. We're also on, my club is on Facebook as @RiseVolleyballAcademy. I'm also on Instagram @RiseVolleyball. Or honestly, my email is just my first name, Lauren, Loren, @RiseVolleyballAcademy.net. And I'm always more than happy to have a conversation with anybody about anything that has to do with coaching through email. So those are the easy ways. And then if people wanted to, you know, explore any of these other topics that I've talked about or whatever, I've done, at this point, it's actually a surprisingly large amount of podcasts where I'm talking about one or another of these different things. And certainly none of these ideas are my original thoughts. They're all, I'm definitely standing on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, I think I'm original in that I brought so many different of these ideas into one space, into my gym, and I'm practicing them every day. But they're certainly not necessarily original ideas where I'm claiming to have invented this new thought process of coaching or whatever. And there's a lot of amazing people out there that I still learn from every day when it comes to this. So if somebody wanted to know who those people were or whatever, I'm going to always point them in that direction as well.
Awesome. Lauren, just a final note, you know, before we kind of round things up, and just by having this conversation with me now, you've kind of, you know, you've made yourself part of the coaches network. So, you know, I'm just curious to know, what is the one message that you'd want to leave with everyone else?
Oh gosh, you got one of those kick butt questions at the end, don't you? I guess, oh man, there's so many different ones, but let me pick a good one here. How about don't be the limit of your player's ability? I think that's probably one big one for me. I feel like when you're the coach-centered, directive, prescripted style of coach, that means you will always be the limit of their ability. And I think that when you turn the journey over to them and let it be their journey, they can grow past you. And sometimes that's tough as a coach to recognize that a player has outgrown you, doesn't need you, is ready to be challenged by somebody else. But I think it's so important to recognize that it's their journey, and all we are is a stop on the map. And if they want to keep going, then you gotta encourage them to keep going. And so, you know, don't be the limit. Don't make yourself be the limit of their ability, I think is something I try to remind myself every day.
Fantastic. Lauren, thank you again for your time today. It's been very much a pleasure of mine. And I'm sure there's, like I said, you know, there's plenty of things we can kind of go on and talk to. And I'd love to kind of maybe catch up over another conversation later down the line. But I want to thank you again for your time today and hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
Yeah, it's been great. I really appreciate it. It's been an honor to be part of it. So thank you for having me on.
Cool. Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.